It's time for Agribiz, agriculture. It's your business. Here are some of the top headlines you need to hear with Rusty Halverson and Sarah Heinrich.
Good morning and welcome back to another episode of Agribiz from the KFGO studio. I'm Rusty Halverson, and we say good morning to Sarah Heinrich at the ranch in Medina. How's it going, Sarah?
Good Sunday morning. Things are good. As we were visiting earlier, Rusty, spring planting is starting to get underway, and that gets me excited for that spring planting itch.
Yeah, a warm weekend last weekend turned into kind of a cool, windy, rainy work week in some parts of the region, and that's good for soil moisture, but perhaps not so good for warming up the soils out there.
Agreed. And so, you know, I think a lot of producers were welcoming the rain, and that was a welcome sight. But as you were saying, you know, it has slowed down planting progress, but we are starting to see some fertilizer spreaders out there, some small grains going in, and some producers getting a chance to get some of that field work at least started, which is an early start compared to what we saw last year.
Now, before many growers even put the first seed in the ground, Sarah, they've got a plan in place, a marketing plan in mind for the year. And soybean growers in our area, they've got a new choice for marketing their soybeans this season. And that's a story we've been following since December of 2021. And you've got the latest update this week.
And it's a hard story to miss. If you drive down I-94 at Castleton, you've probably noticed the North Dakota soybean processors and that soy processing plant going up. It's an exciting time, as you said, really a new market venture for soybean producers out there. And I had a chance to visit with Zach Spilker and just visit with him about some of the marketing opportunities that are available for producers as when they'll start taking grain.
We have Zach Spilker, who is joining us with the North Dakota Soybean Processors in Castleton, and we're talking a little bit about that new facility. You see it when you're driving down I-94. Zach, visit with me about really that excitement that's brewing, because it won't be long until you guys are starting to accept some crop.
Yeah, we'll be taking old crop beans last half July. So we're currently contracting for last half July all the way out to March, and then also new crop all the way out to 2025. And then we're doing futures only is all the way for 2026. So very flexible for your marketing plan.
You have been here every step of the way and really watched this come to fruition. Let's talk a little bit about kind of that excitement. It has to be really neat to see a facility like this come to completion.
Yeah, starting out with a $400+ million project. It's amazing to see all the work that's gone into it. I think we broke ground August of 2022, and we're going to be finishing up here this year, definitely ready for 2024 crop. So it's extremely exciting.
Talk to me about the size and the magnitude of the facility, how many bushels you guys can handle, and what you're looking to do on a daily basis.
Yeah, we'll be doing 125,000 bushels of beans per day. So it works out to about 3.75 million bushels per month, or about 100,000 acres worth of beans per month. So amazing for all the area farmers in eastern North Dakota.
All right, Zach, if a farmer wants to get a hold of you, what's the best way?
Yeah, best way is just to call us 701-895-1010 and press 1 for merchandising. We're there to help you out and get the best price for your beans.
Another topic we've been watching closely, Sarah, is the Biden administration's push for a net zero emissions economy by no later than 2050. And that's got some possible opportunities for agriculture, whether it be renewable diesel from soybeans or sustainable aviation fuel using corn ethanol. But some questions remain out there, Sarah.
I think there are a lot of questions surrounding this industry. When we visit with farmers, they're wanting to know more about this, how they could possibly benefit their own operation. I had a chance to visit with Andrew Mauch, who serves as the North Dakota Corn Growers Association's president, really about how ethanol markets are being impacted by carbon capture and sequestration and how it affects corn producers.
This is kind of a huge impact to corn producers, I think, especially when you talk about sustainable aviation fuel and how the ethanol that, you know, when we bring our corn to the ethanol plants and they make ethanol, if we can lower the CI score, carbon intensity score of that particular ethanol plant to be able to play in these sustainable aviation fuel markets, it's going to be, to me, it's a game changer. It's, you know, one thing that I think probably the single most important thing that I'll see in my farming career is this, if we can get into this market and have it be sustainable and being the things that we can do to go forward. forward, I don't see there's a bigger market and demand in my farming career. So I just think this is huge. And, you know, to be able to get that CI score down with this technology that we have now, it's about the only thing we can to get down far enough. The carbon sequestration project will lower the CI scores of ethanol plants by about 30 points there. So that's kind of what they need to get to be eligible to be in those markets.
What would be your advice for growers out there who are saying, you know what, I feel like I need to be learning more about this topic?
Just asking questions. I mean, this topic is very evolving and kind of a moving target. There's still a lot of unanswered questions. There's still a lot of people that, you know, I would say most people don't hardly believe, at least in this area, don't really believe that, you know, this carbon is, you know, doing the things they say they should be doing and this and that. And that's okay to have that opinion. But what the difference is, I think, is, you know, to be able to export to European countries and Canada just announced, I want to say in July of 2023, that they are kind of going that direction as well with the lower CI scores and with the, you know, the airline industry goals for sustainable aviation fuel and, you know, like I said, going into European markets, they're all kind of going that direction that needs to be a lower carbon intensity score. And so whether you believe it or not, unfortunately, it seems like that's the way the world's going. So it just, you know, we need to ask questions. You know, there's a lot of misconceptions out there of how it works, what we need to do and all those things. And so we just need to ask questions and try to find out. And like I said, it's a moving target. So what we know today is definitely going to change in the coming months and going forward too. So it just almost got to have an open mind a little bit too.
And still to come on Agribiz, corn ethanol's impact on the future. Farmers are working to understand that intersection of corn ethanol and carbon intensity. Rusty Halverson will have more on that coming up next.
Welcome back to Agribiz. I'm Rusty Halverson. Before we return to the carbon conversation, in Washington, D.C. this past week, the Senate Ag Appropriations Committee held a hearing Tuesday to examine the president's fiscal year 2025 budget request for USDA. Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack detailed several priorities for agriculture in the president's budget request. Ag Appropriations Committee Ranking Member John Hoven of North Dakota asked Secretary Vilsack about his thoughts on improving crop insurance in the Farm Bill. Hoven recently introduced the Federal Agriculture Risk Management Enhancement and Resilience Act, or Farmer Act, legislation to strengthen crop insurance and make higher levels of coverage more affordable for producers.
Well, I think we need to continue to look for ways in which we can expand coverage. More products, more crops basically being covered. There's still not everything that's grown and raised in this country has the same level or opportunity. We've had 12 new products and 50 modifications to existing policies. I think we need to do more of that. I think we do need to take, you know, there's a conflicting set of messages coming out of this capital on crop insurance. There's some who, in your circumstance, are suggesting an increase in commitment from the federal government so that the farmers have to pay a little bit less for more coverage. Then there's some folks on the House side who are suggesting significant reductions in that safety net. Mm-hmm. I think we need perhaps some consistency in the approach here would be helpful.
Well, we prefer our approach.
Well, I'm sure you do. But there are 166 members of the House Republican caucus that feel that crop insurance should be cut.
Vilsack also faced questions from Hoven regarding the U.S. trade deficit in agriculture. USDA recently raised its fiscal year 2024 agricultural export and import forecasts by $1 billion each, holding steady its estimate of a $30.5 billion U.S. ag trade deficit in 2024. Fiscal year 2024 exports are now forecast at $170.5 billion, while imports are estimated at $201 billion.
This is an interesting statistic. Maybe it's just coincidental. Our trade deficit for the first 3 months of fiscal year 24 was $6 billion. Bought $6 billion more than we sold. China purchased $6 billion less.
Yeah, I knew that's where you were going. Yeah. Coincidence, no, right?
Well, look, if you continually wrap your number one customer, it's not surprising that your number one customer would send you a signal about, hey, we're paying attention. So what has to happen, I think, is a much more nuanced and sophisticated conversation about China. You mentioned family farms. What's a greater risk, Chinese ownership of farmland or the fact that Wall Street and investment banks own a third of the largest farm operations in the country? 50,000 farms or so owned by investors, not by farm families. Which is a greater risk?
What can we do on the trade front? But again, we need to be tougher on trade. I think there's both trade barriers and non-trade barriers that we've got to knock down. We've got to be tougher there. What do we do here?
I can give you a list of $20 billion of trade wins we've had. They're doubles and singles. They're not home runs, but they are. The cumulative impact and effect is important. The WRAP program that we initiated at the request of Senator Bozeman and Senator Stabenow, important because it expands our opportunity to diversify, more people, more presence, more promotion, more opportunities for trade missions. You're going to see that more emphasis in Africa and Southeast Asia, moving away from the over-reliance on China. I think that's an important consideration.
The North Dakota Ethanol Council hosted a corn ethanol webinar featuring Dr. David Ripplinger of North Dakota State University on Tuesday of this week, discussing the future of North Dakota's ethanol industry.
We're really at a crossroads where there's going to be a lot of changes that are going to be impacting farmers as well as the biofuel industry. Some of those will be elective. Many of them are going to be all but required in order to really have market access for both biofuel feedstocks as well as for other food crops that we might grow in the state.
Ripplinger acknowledges there's been a lot of interest and activity in carbon, in greenhouse gases, and climate.
It's impacting industries in different ways, government in different ways, and that's certainly true for the biofuel industry. And as we look at what's going to happen in the future, the primary characteristic that's going to drive value in ethanol is its carbon footprint. It is a lower carbon fuel per unit of energy than gasoline, but it needs to continue to maintain or reduce that level in order to maintain or possibly increase its value in the marketplace.
Ripplinger says much of the discussion has come from the state of California and the state's low carbon fuel standard.
That law mandates the use of fuel with an ever smaller carbon footprint. So each year, the average carbon footprint has to be smaller than the year before and so on. And the neat thing about the policy, which is overseen by the California Air Resources Board, which is essentially California EPA, is that it doesn't tell anyone what they have to do. It doesn't say corn ethanol, you're in this bucket and we need to use this much. Instead, it says, if you bring fuel to market, if it has a higher carbon footprint, that's fine, but you're going to need to bring some fuel with a lower carbon footprint or pay for a credit from someone who does. And it's been very, very impactful because it incentivizes innovation to reduce carbon footprints generally, to reduce greenhouse emissions generally, and then also to allow investments and innovations bringing new biofuels to market. And we see that most obviously recently with renewable diesel.
Given California's policy and low-carbon fuel policies in other countries like Canada, Ripplinger says the situation is relatively clear.
And we'll see exactly how this all plays out, but to me, it really can't be ignored. And this is in tandem with other things that are food as well, where if your carbon footprint is too big or you don't have a carbon intensity estimate, you may not be able to sell into certain markets.
Ripplinger says the sustainable aviation fuel market holds vast potential for the ethanol industry if the fuel can qualify for the market.
You have to have a carbon footprint that's substantially smaller or below a certain level to even qualify to be defined as a sustainable aviation fuel.
And Ripplinger thinks North Dakota ethanol could be relatively well positioned for the future.
We have very good rail access into Canada, so we've marketed a considerable amount of ethanol into British Columbia. We have a unique fleet of ethanol refineries in the state. Spiritwood, you know, using waste steam from a coal-fired power plant, small carbon footprint. Same thing with Blue Flint. We now have both Red Trail and Blue Flint having carbon capture. Tharaldson, being large and big, has, you know, some efficiency advantages. The idea is, yeah, if you have that smaller carbon footprint, you want to get it to those markets. And we've been really fortunate in the state to have refineries who have done that and continue to do that.
Looking forward, Riplinger says refiners will have a growing interest in the practices that farmers use to produce their crops.
It's a challenge because, first of all, there's a typically a very strong relationship between a refiner and their corn farmers and vice versa. There's within the corn ethanol industry, there's a very strong understanding of current and evolving emerging opportunities. It's not quite there today where you can just flip a switch and do it. But all of this thought and investment and thinking about, you know, what technology might we need? What type of validation system might we need? What change in government policy might we be looking for certain markets? That's absolutely at the forefront of a lot of the forward-looking thinkers in the corn ethanol industry.
North Dakota's corn ethanol industry currently has six refineries with a capacity of 550 million gallons per year. Now, carbon is one of the hottest buzzwords when it comes to industry and farming. Here's a question. In the future, if a standardized method was available to score the carbon sequestration benefits of a piece of land, is that a measurable value of improvement to the land that would make it worth more money? For example, tiled land can improve drainage and productivity. That improvement to the land usually results in a higher land value or a premium over neighboring land, say, for example, if it comes up for sale at an auction. Could a piece of land with well-documented sustainability practices fetch a higher price, whether that be minimum tillage, cover cropping, or rotational grazing? I pose that question to North Dakota Ag Commissioner Doug Goring and former House Ag Committee Chair Colin Peterson, who is now a consultant for the American Carbon Alliance.
You know, I've been telling people, we're putting carbon in the ground all the time, but we have no way to measure it, you know, and we don't get credit for it.
There's some value attached to the land, and but more often than not, it's about the practices or the system you have in place. So if you add tile and you have the ability to manage that land a little bit different, a little bit better, yeah, you're adding some value to it, and because of the ability to sequester carbon. But the same is true, your practices and the system you have in place is really doing more to add value or to sequester carbon than it is about pulling out the six bottom plow, I think I heard in there, and turning that soil over, doing deep tillage, and just going out and planting the way you want. It really does come down to the producer and the practices that are in place and whatever investments or improvements they've made to the land.
The crops actually take carbon out of the air and put it in the ground. Yeah. The problem is then we harvest the crops and then we're putting it back in again. And they're not measuring that stuff. Yeah. See, so I told the sugar beet guys, you know, there must be a lot of carbon going into a sugar beet. You know, so then you go and process them and you put it into sugar. How much carbon are you putting back in? You can't be putting as much as what you took out. Mm-hmm. But we don't measure it. We don't know how to measure it. You know? Okay. So,
yeah, maybe someday, but we need to measure.
What I'm worried about is the enviros, when they get a hold of any of this stuff, they'll use it against us.
Yes.
You know, that's what I'm worried about.
That's former House Ag Committee Chair Colin Peterson and North Dakota Ag Commissioner Doug Goring. Speaking of land, coming up next, it's time for another episode of Auction Talk with Steffes Group. We talk with Max Steffes about first quarter land sales, the carbon conversation, and more. That's straight ahead on the Mighty 790 and 104.7 KFGO. It's time now for another episode of Auction Talk with Steffes Group. Third-generation auctioneer Max Steffes stopped into the studio this past week, and we talked about several topics. First quarter land sales, the carbon conversation in agriculture, land values during a presidential election year, and also some of the hottest selling items for the month of March. Let's join that conversation with Max Steffes.
We're in a really interesting spot right now, Rusty, because we have 390 corn in locally record land prices. We do some news articles on our website, and one of the articles that we published was top land auction highlights for quarter one in 2024. Start at the top, Jasper County, Iowa, $17,000 an acre. Turn the page, Maurer County, Minnesota, $12,600 an acre. Henry County, Iowa, $16,000 an acre.
Mm-hmm.
Cass County, North Dakota, that's our county for those listening in Fargo, $11,160 an acre.
$11,160 an acre.
Yeah, so it's just remarkable what's going on in spite of the leading indicators, if you will. And the leading indicators that we look at, first and foremost, commodity prices. Second would be interest rates, and third would be yields. We're seeing record land prices on the high end, but at the same time, things are changing a little bit. And that's hard for people to, well, they see the record prices, but how can land prices be changing? Well, behind the scenes, marginal land is correcting, and marginal land tends to be an indicator in terms of when markets correct. It's always the last land up and the first land down, and we're seeing that now.
Kind of a canary in the coal mine.
Canary in the coal mine, yeah. That's a good way of putting it, yep.
Okay. Now, for some of this land, and if folks want to check this out, it's at steffesgroup.com. You've got the article up there. They can go down and look through all those sales. But, for example, it's kind of what caught me was it's kind of the usual suspects. We always hear about Iowa land values being usually top of the market, very highly regarded when it comes to quality of the land. And when folks look through that article, they might see some terms they might not be familiar with, such as corn suitability rating, perhaps a productivity index, soil productivity index, or SPI values. Can you kind of give a broad overview of what those values mean to the average listener out there, Max?
Yeah, so we'll start here regionally. We have soil productivity indexes, and that's a measure of the overall income, or not income producing, but productivity of the land.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a scale from 0 to 100, with 100 being the very best, 50 being about average. Most of the land here in the valley is going to be in that 80 to 90 productivity range.
Okay.
Up here, it's not down to a science quite like they have it down in Iowa. So I always tell people that productivity numbers aren't gospel. Okay. They don't tell you the whole picture and the whole story.
Sure.
I'll use our family's farm by Arthur, North Dakota, for example. We have some land in what we call Section 10.
Okay.
That's got a 70, in the 70s productivity, and it'll produce 200 bushel corn like a rock. Oh. We also have some land that's 90. In the 90s,
mm-hmm.
the 70 is better than the 90.
Really?
Which, and there's a lot of instances like that in the valley. So you really got to take a whole total look at the property, drainage, what's the water table like, access, and all those other attributes of the farm. Conversely to that, in Iowa, the corn suitability rating, or CSR, that's what they have down in Iowa. They have that down to a science.
Okay.
And that's a product of Iowa State University's work through the decades and generations. They've been studying land value since the early 1900s in ways that we really haven't.
Really?
Yeah. So I hope one day that it'll be developed up here the way it is down there, but they'll bank off of corn suitability rating down there. The bankers will say, well, land's been bringing $175 a CSR point, and they'll be within $500 an acre of a property that sells at auction, just based on that per CSR point in the county.
Wow. To get it dialed in like that for our area, Max, do we need more data? What do we need to different to get it to so bulletproof like Iowa does it?
You know, they just don't, I don't know if we'll ever get to that point up here. It sure would be nice, but we have so many more variables that they don't have with weather.
Good point.
They don't have crop failures like we do.
Yep.
And it'd be difficult for us to get to that point. But, you know, I think data would be a good place to start once, sale data becomes more publicly available. We might get to that point. You're starting to see that a little bit with sources like Acre Value, which tracks farmland sales. There's all sorts of Zillow type sites out there where you can go on and see what properties have brought. And as big tech aggregates some of that data, we might get to the point where we're able to bank off of that soil productivity number, but we aren't there yet.
You know, you bring that up. Maybe is that an area where AI could eventually maybe someday play a role in that kind of data crunching, do you think?
Well, isn't AI going to fix everything?
Oh, that's what they tell us.
Who knows, right?
Can it fix my golf swing?
Yeah, I don't know.
And, you know, you bring that up, the different factors. I looked into it a little bit, Max. The factors that go into soil ratings. One, adequate management. I would suppose that would be whether or not the land has had a good farmer on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so soil productivity, I don't believe it takes into account how it's been farmed.
Okay.
So it's a historical look at the soils that are there. Each soil is given a rating, and the ratings are assigned to each soil type, and then you get a weighted average for the field that you're looking at. So farming practices would be an example that wouldn't, if you have a tenant on there that's raping and pillaging the land, the soil productivity number is not going to be any lower or higher because of those practices.
Oh.
If you have a farmer that's really taking care of the land, that the productivity numbers aren't going to be elevated. There's no way of measuring that on an annual basis.
Okay. Now, when you talk about being able to measure, you and I had talked a little bit before the show about the discussion when it comes to carbon and carbon sequestration of the soils. And I had kind of tossed out a hypothetical question, just a big question. Will we see this 10 years, 20 years, 50 years down the road? Will we ever see value attached to land through the farming practices that have been used on it to sequester carbon, capture carbon in the soil? And I think the point that you brought up, can you measure it? Can you define it?
Can you measure it? Can you define it? And then what's the quantitative benefits economically?
Mm-hmm.
I think everybody's got to view it as a valuable thing first, as a valuable measure. And that comes with money, of course.
Yeah.
And I think once the money comes and you can measure and define that, I think it would be an attribute that we would certainly include in our sales brochures one day, maybe.
Maybe.
We're not there yet. And that's a big question. How do we measure it? There's farming practices that you just brought up. How do you measure that on an annual basis based on what the producer is doing to that land? Because we're taking carbon out and we're putting carbon in every year.
Yep.
And how do you measure that? Because that number would theoretically change.
Yeah.
So I don't know if we'll get to that point or not. Mm. It's an interesting conversation, though.
Yeah. All right. Putting the theoretical carbon discussion behind us, what are some things, some of those leading indicators that we can track at this time? What are you watching, Max?
Well, the three historical leading indicators that we always look at is commodity prices first, interest rates second, and third would be yields, what the farmer's getting in that local vicinity.
Mm-hmm.
And there's other factors, though, that I'm watching right now. One would be, you know, we're in such a pumped up, supercharged economy right now. Everybody knows by now that our dollar is very obviously worth less as we sit here in the year 2024 than it was worth, say, pre-COVID.
And folks can go to the grocery store and figure that out, trying to put food on the table.
Yes, and farmers know that by sliding parts across the counter at the dealership and buying equipment at our auctions and buying land at our auctions. So our dollar is very obviously worth less. So is the land bringing more, or is our dollar worth less? That's a question. Probably a little bit of both. The other factor that I really look at is there's many well-heeled farmers and farm families out there who value land above most worldly possessions. And as a product of that mindset, they're willing to stick their neck out and make that purchase still. And they have excess cash. There's a lot of sugar beet farmers here in the Valley that made in excess of $1,500 an acre last year. They've got cash. Sure, the leading indicators aren't good. 390 corn, we know the forecast isn't good, but hey, they got $2, $3 million sitting in their checking account. And if a good quarter comes up for sale, what else are they gonna do with the money?
Yeah.
They'd much rather buy a nice quarter of land than go buy stock at a sky-high inflated value or give it to the banker and earn 5%. They'd rather put it back into their operation and buy that land. So as a product of that mindset and that pent-up surplus of cash, I'll say, they're willing to spend any excess cash on those parcels of land that become available, which is leading to some of these record land prices.
All right, we're going to come back in just a moment. More Auction Talk with Steffes Group. Coming up next on the Mighty 790 and 104.7 KFGO. Welcome back to Auction Talk with Steffes Group. I'm Rusty Halverson, and we've got Max Steffes in the studio. Max, we crowned a new basketball champion the end of March Madness there. UConn winning it all. When we talk about March Madness in agricultural equipment sales, what have you seen here recently?
Well, quarter one was certainly a busy one for us, and we were fortunate enough to have several large-scale dealership auctions. And, you know, some of the highlights from March, we'll just read through the top three. News article on our website if you guys are curious. But item number four, the 9R540, $446,000. That machine was a 2022 CMB equipment sold the auction in Miller, South Dakota. Number two would have been a sprayer, a John Deere 616R for $501,000.
Wow.
Number one, a 9RX640 sold on the Williston Area Farm Equipment Auction out at our Williston Yard for $600,000. So notice that most of this equipment was green in nature, and it just speaks to what's going on in terms of these dealerships managing their inventory.
Yeah. There seems to be so much of this lately, Max. What's going on with the dealers?
It all has to do with supply and the supply chain issues and the dealerships not getting certain model years of equipment available to farmers. So they got stuck with a glut of machinery, and they're now trying to manage through that. And frankly, there's a correction going on. So Deere and these dealership groups are betting that this market's probably going to correct a little bit, and they want to take advantage of the markets that we're in.
Uh-huh.
And on top of the fact that, hey, they've got 400 combines, 500 combines that they got to manage through.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of numbers and sheer volume and managing through those. And we are in a little bit of a correction. So they're looking at the marketplace just like we are from a buyer side. Hey, you know, is it going to get cheaper? Is it going to go up? Mm-hmm. And making those decisions. But we're luckily a benefactor of that in terms of they're utilizing the auction method of marketing. And for buyers and bidders that are listening, great opportunity for you folks to bid your price on this late model equipment.
Yeah, just kind of popped into my mind that the relationship that you have with dealers in circumstances such as this, kind of symbiotic, helpful to both parties.
It is. It is. It seems like the dealership groups are our good friends when the market's doing this. They like us. Of course, some of the dealership groups maybe view us as a little bit of as a competitor, you know, if they're trying to sell the new piece. But we've got great relationships with many of the farm dealership groups throughout the region and throughout the nation, frankly.
Okay, let's talk about a little bit about the calendar before we wrap it up for this week. But we're right on the cusp of planting season. Will things slow down for you at Steffes Group a bit before we ramp up again in summer? What's the general trend when we hit spring planting, Max?
Historically, it's been as soon as the first of May rolls around, things get really quiet in our world. But with the online-only auction process, that's changed a little bit. And I would like to say that we're going to be quiet in May, but there's going to be a lot of dealership groups doing some business with us this spring, and also some last-minute land auctions that are going to be coming to our attention, too, where people are going to try to do some land auctions here before the 15th of May. So be watching for those at steffesgroup.com.
That is steffesgroup.com. We say it all the time when we talk during the week, Max.
We do.
We do. thank you for coming into the studio. It's been another good episode, and we'll see you next time.
Yeah, we'll see you, Rusty. Thanks so much.
You can hear the entire conversation of Auction Talk with Steffes Group on the KFGO website, on the podcast page. And you can hear this entire episode of Agribiz on the podcast page as well. That's going to do it for this week's episode of the Agribiz Show. For Sarah Heinrich, I'm Rusty Halverson on the Mighty 790 and 104.7 KFGO.